Welcome to Wednesday's edition of Big Blue Kickoff Live here on Giants.com. He is Paul DeTino. I'm Lance Medel with you for the next 60 minutes. 201-939-4513 is the telephone number. Hashtag Giants Chat on Twitter. It is all presented by Coors Light. We're going to continue to preview the Giants' 2019 opponents. Today we're going to focus on another NFC North foe, and that is the Chicago Bears, who had an extremely impressive 2018 campaign, a dominant defense, an opportunistic defense, and I think, Paul, now the key is, can they build off of that despite that Vic Fangio, their defensive coordinator, is now the head coach of the Denver Broncos?
Well, you know, we talk about this all the time as to when a superstar coordinator leaves, how much of an impact is it going to have on the guys who are left behind? Now, just because he was a big-name coordinator who did great things doesn't necessarily mean that he's leaving remnants in his wake. This could certainly wind up being a very good defense nonetheless.
100%. The core is still together, and to learn more about whether or not this Bears defense can pick up where it left off with Vic Fangio, who's now Denver's head coach, we're now joined by a very special guest to further break down the Bears, and that is none other than Kevin Fishbane, who covers the Bears for The Athletic. Kevin, you got Lance Medel, Paul DeTino here on Giants.com, Big Blue Kickoff Live. Greatly appreciate the time today. How's everything?
I'm doing well, guys. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Well, thank you. Kevin, let's start where Paul and I began the conversation initially about the Bears. And there are a lot of question marks for a team that looked solid last year and had a heartbreaking postseason loss. But they lose Vic Fangio and they bring in Chuck Pagano, an experienced coach, an experienced coordinator. How much of a toll do you think that's going to have on the defense, the fact that you've got a new voice leading that group?
Yeah, well, you know, I think Chuck Pagano is probably the best option of all the different people they could have brought in. I mean, you couldn't really ask for a better replacement for Vic Fangio than Chuck Pagano, who has obviously a wealth of experience, especially in the 3-4 defense. And there's going to be wrinkles, and there's going to be learning curves, and the guys have been upfront that it hasn't been necessarily easy. You know, you're learning a new playbook, but this is an interesting group because it's still pretty young. But you have a lot of guys who just experienced a lot of success for the first time in their career. So there's a lot of confidence. So, you know, if there's going to be a step back on defense, I don't know if that's going to be Chuck Pagano related so much so that they just set such a ridiculously high bar last year with their numbers across the board. They were the best defense in football based on football from a Football Outsiders DVOA metric in the last 7 years. So, you know, it's just going to be really tough for them to stay as healthy as they did last year and to, you know, take the ball away at the rate they did last year just because of the ebbs and flows of the NFL. I think that's going to be more of a reason that they might step back as opposed to the impact of having a new coordinator.
I totally appreciate the fact that you asked about the DC first, Lance, and his answer is certainly very well thought out. But I can't help but ask about the kicking situation. To me, that's just the big pink elephant in the room because we know what happened last year in the playoff game against the Philadelphia Eagles. And correct me if I'm wrong now, they've had like a half a dozen guys come through the door at the position over the course of the last several months. I mean, it's musical chairs as they try to solve this thing. How much confidence do they have that they'll be able to get it done?
Yeah, it's been the story of the summer. I like to call it the most attention-grabbing job search in Chicago this summer, right up there with mayor after we elected our new mayor here. So, you know, they had 9 place kickers during rookie minicamp.
Nine. See, I undershot.
Eight kickers and 1 punter who did some place kicking as well. They whittled that down to 4. That got whittled down to 3, and now we're heading into training camp with 2. And I appreciate what they're doing. This is, I can't believe there's ever been a kicking competition like this. They are doing everything they can to make this difficult, to make this challenging for the guys, because they're trying to, you know, make artificial pressure. You know, because, you know, the physical aspects of kicking, they'll be able to do different things to figure out who is the best pure kicker. But they're trying to find somebody who, at a very fickle position, can handle the pressure, something Cody Parkey couldn't do last year. I actually had a commenter on one of my stories bring this up yesterday, which I hadn't really thought about. It's a very simple point, but he said, why is everyone saying that kicker's the problem? Kicker was the problem last year, and the Bears were still pretty good, even though they had a bad kicker. So, you know, I think... The thing is I don't think this is going to be solved. I think all year there's going to be a lot of tension over who's kicking, and I do think it's going to be a problem. I do think it could be a hindrance for this team, and it puts more pressure on everybody else around them to improve, to ascend, to be better. But they're just hoping to find their own Justin Tucker. I mean, you guys saw it in New York last year. The way the Giants were able to kind of find somebody, you know, that nobody had heard of to be a good kicker. That's what the Bears are hoping to do through this competition. And I wouldn't be surprised, guys, if the two guys who are heading to Bourbonnais training camp as the kickers, that neither of them is the week one kicker. I think this still has a long way to go.
Truly amazing. You know, if they had to do it all over again, would they have ever allowed Robbie Gould to walk out the door?
It's the ultimate question. You know, Robbie had a rough summer that year. He wasn't great in the preseason. He was missing kicks that we were not used to seeing him miss in training camp and practice, and he was making a lot of money. And this was, at the time, a new coaching staff who did not have necessarily connection to Robbie that the previous coaching staff and previous regime had. And even Robbie's understood that as from a business standpoint, he wasn't kicking at the level of what he was getting paid at that time. Mm-hmm. And he has acknowledged he changed his game. You guys saw it there with his one year with the Giants, and then certainly what he's done with the 49ers. But it's hard to kind of play that game, because at the time it was still stunning, but it did make some sense. Obviously, nobody thought that we'd be the Bears would have 4 to 5 different kickers kicking games now since Robbie left.
Well, and speaking of money, they invested a lot of money in Cody Parkey. So, you know, that obviously is something that's going to eat up some cap space. And the reason I bring that up, Kevin, and this is just pure speculation, but it's well documented, Robbie Gould has yet to sign his franchise tender with San Francisco. Is it possible Chicago will explore trade scenarios? And could you envision a situation where maybe they try to pursue Gould and work something out with San Fran?
I think if we've learned anything from the Bears general manager, Ryan Pace, you can't rule anything out. he is very aggressive.
Yeah.
You know, if you guys told me last year the Bears were going to trade for Khalil Mack, I think I would have called you crazy. I would have said no way. So you can't rule anything out, which I think is a good thing with the general manager. My issue with that scenario, guys, is if you're John Lynch, why would you trade Robbie Gould? You're not going to. It's a kicker, so you're not going to get a lot. And you certainly don't want to trade him to a team that's in the conference that is maybe a Robbie Gould away from being a legitimate Super Bowl contender.
That's fair.
I think if you're John Lynch, you play that game of chicken and you wait all the way till the Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday of week one, because the 49ers have said that Robbie can show up that week and kick and they'll be fine. It's not like a different position on the field where you need that training with the team. So I think if you're John Lynch, you wait it out and you just hope that he shows up for that first game of the season, because I'm not sure what he gets out of sending Robbie Gould to a team that's in your conference. When you're not going to, I mean, this is not a quarterback or receiver where you can maybe get a second, third, fourth round pick. This is a kicker. So I don't know how much they would be able to even get from the Bears for that. But again, if you're the Bears, I think you have to keep that possibility open.
Well, Kevin, we started with defense, and I'd like to go back there just a second before we flip it to the other side of the ball. Prince Amukamara, former first round pick of the Giants, did well with the Giants. I thought he was a good player. He did have some injury issues and maybe at times did not play up to the billing that maybe they had hoped to get out of him. But it seems to me, after a pit stop in Jacksonville, he has played extremely well for the Bears, at least from afar. That appears to be the scouting report on him. What has allowed him, in your estimation, to become a top-flight corner in this league?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting, guys, because his first year with the Bears, it was really challenging for him, because if you looked at just his coverage, if you watched him game by game, you could tell quarterbacks were not throwing his side of the field. He had fantastic coverage. One of the reasons Kyle Fuller had so many plays in the football in 2017 was because quarterbacks weren't throwing at Prince, but he didn't have an interception. And then he ended that drought last year. He had 3 interceptions. He had a really big pick 6 in week 2 to beat Seattle. And so the coverage was always there. It was just now you got to make plays. And he had to bring down the penalty number. The penalties were an issue his first year in Chicago. He brought that down. And he's just been a really steady player for them where they can just kind of rely on him. They don't have to worry that much about that side of the field. Now, durability, as you guys know very well, with Prince was always his issue.
Yeah.
In New York, in Jacksonville, even in Chicago, he's missed. He still hasn't played 16 games, I think, since his second year in the league. So, which is interesting because this is someone that no one would ever question his work ethic or how he takes care of his body. He just, you know, happens to be injury prone. He played in 15 games last year, which is really helpful. So he's been fully healthy this offseason. But obviously, he's 30. You know, he's getting to that point in his career where you wonder how much more he can ascend. Necessarily, he's got a big cap number coming up in 2020, but he's been great for the locker room. It was something I'm sure you guys know from his time in New York, and he's just been just solid in coverage. I asked somebody, you know, in the front office, I said, you know, how would you describe Prince? They just said reliable, that they're just able to count on him. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of that goes to his experience and kind of his ability to know what he's supposed to do every play.
We're talking with Kevin Fishbane, who covers the Bears for The Athletic. The Giants are going to visit the Bears week 12, November 24th, as we're previewing the Giants' 2019 opponents. Staying in the secondary, Kevin, I think probably the biggest change for Chicago's secondary is Adrian Amos, one of their safeties, going to the rival Green Bay Packers, and then Chicago filling the void, which I think was a good value deal in bringing in Ha-Ha Clinton-Dix, because, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was only a one-year, $3 million deal compared to what other safeties got that was actually could go down as a bargain deal. But how do you see the dynamics changing? Because Eddie Jackson had such a great season at the other safety spot in terms of bringing now in Ha-Ha Clinton-Dix and trying to fill the void left behind by Adrian Amos.
Yeah, it's really interesting because Amos and Clinton-Dix are very different players. You know, Adrian Amos was always in the right spot. He didn't necessarily make a ton of plays on the ball, but you didn't have to worry about him. He was a great tackler. He started to kind of help in the takeaway category the last two seasons. And then Clinton-Dix is the type of guy who has that playmaking ability, but is also kind of prone to giving up a big play. One of the reasons the Packers traded him in the middle of last season. I tell you what, guys, based on Twitter and message boards, you talk about George Halas, Vince Lombardi, Ha-Ha Clinton-Dix, Adrian Amos has really added to the Bears-Packers rivalry. as again, two different players, two different contracts, but you're absolutely right. It was about value. It was about getting a guy who wants to go ahead and do a prove-it deal for a good team. He and Jackson both went to Alabama. They know each other well. We're all interested to see how do two kind of free safeties work together. You know, neither is known for their run stopping ability. And that's where you rely on Chuck Pagano. Chuck Pagano's specialty is safeties. We all saw what happened with Ed Reed. That's where he kind of got his start at University of Miami. Pagano did. So I think that's where if you're a Bears fan, you're like, okay, Pagano's going to figure this out. You don't put these two guys together and you have the faith that he's going to make sure it works. It's going to be different, but the Bears are obviously kind of putting in, as you said, just a $3 million bet. That's going to work out pretty well for them.
Let me flip it over to offense for a second. How do you suppose this running game is going to sort itself out?
Nobody knows. It's a huge mystery, and it's pretty funny, too, because – you know, last year we had so many questions about what Jordan Howard's role was going to be, and he ended up being the number one back, like Matt Nagy had been telling us, but obviously he just wasn't as effective. My assumption, based on what I've seen, what I've heard, is David Montgomery is going to be the guy. I think he is going to be your first and second down back. He's going to be the one that leads this team in carries. They love this kid, and, they traded up for him in the third round. He looked really impressive, you know, in OTAs. Obviously no pads on yet, so you can't really tell, especially with that running back position. But I was trying to watch the way he ran routes, which is something that was really a limitation for Jordan Howard. And you can tell the difference with Montgomery. Then you got Mike Davis from Seattle. I would imagine he'll be more of your third down back, maybe you're inside the 10-yard line guy. And then there's Tariq Cohen. And, you know, adding Montgomery and Mike Davis maybe gives Tariq Cohen more opportunities to be a wide receiver. And to line up in different places. I mean, he was last year the most electric player on this team, and I expect him to still be that way. And he's getting better. His knowledge of the game is expanding, and Matt Nagy's learning how can I put this guy Tariq Cohen in position to play well for us. And having two other running backs there, maybe you don't need Tariq Cohen to have as many carries. Maybe you can do some more things with him in other ways to get him the ball in the open field. But, back to the original premise, I think that David Montgomery is going to kind of run the show for this group.
Well, and as you noted, Matt Nagy is such a creative coach. He loves to move guys around and try to maximize their value. But, you know, if you move Tariq Cohen into more of a wide receiver role, I'm looking at the roster here, Kevin, and you have Allen Robinson as he was returning from a torn ACL, Taylor Gabriel, who's a very similar jack-of-all-trades guy, and then they bring in Cordarrelle Patterson this offseason, mm-hmm. who is with New England, who you could also move around in the backfield, in the slot, and so forth. So how does that perhaps then change the dynamics of what Nagy does with the receiving core at all?
Yeah, it's a weird thing in Chicago where I believe Musha Muhammad years ago said Chicago's where wide receivers go to die. Harlan Hill still owns the all-time, or one of the receiving record. Johnny Morris is still the all-time franchise leader in receiving yards in a season. Like, this goes back decades, guys. I mean, Brandon Marshall is probably the best skilled receiver the Bears have ever had.
Sure. And
now they finally have depth, as you just said. So, Tariq Cohen, Taylor Gabriel, Cordarrelle Patterson, I kind of put those three guys in the same category as your gadget player. That, Gabriel's going to play a little bit more receiver, but Patterson and Cohen can really move around to a lot of different spots, and you're going to see Patterson come out of the backfield. The one name that I think everyone should really watch this year is Allen Robinson. If you go back to that fourth quarter against the Eagles in the playoffs, he dominated. And he was coming off the torn ACL, and we saw these little flashes here and there of the abilities that he has as number one receiver. He is still very young. He's had a fully healthy offseason now. I think he's primed for really big numbers this season, even in an offense that kind of is known for spreading the wealth. Anthony Miller in the year two. There's a lot of high expectations inside the building for him. But, yeah, it's going to be, it's a lot of competition there, and it's going to be kind of a challenge for Nagy to find ways to get these guys in, get them the ball, and figure out where they go best. But it is kind of, for the Bears, it's just weird to spend a summer being like trying to figure out how you get these guys the ball, as opposed to past summers where you're trying to figure out who the heck are they going to throw the ball to.
Yeah, it's a good problem to have, to your point.
Kevin, I'm an offensive line junkie, so I don't mind telling you that even though I didn't think Bobby Massey was an outstanding tackle, when I looked at free agency back, I guess it was last December, guys who were going to be coming up and coming up to UFA status, I looked at Massey and I said, you know what? He might be the best UFA right tackle out there. That might be an interesting target for some teams like the Giants, who would be looking for a veteran right tackle. Well, the Bears didn't let that happen. They decided to retain him at a pretty good buck. I'm kind of curious as to what you think their thinking was in keeping Massey around. Is he even better than I thought? Is that why they figured they could not afford to lose him?
Yeah, it's a great point, and I think when the contract first got announced, people were like, wait a second, why are they paying Bobby Massey this much money? And then you start to see what happens when free agency begins, and you realize, oh, they got themselves a little hometown discount, and now you're able to bring back all five starting offensive linemen. Bobby Massey's first game as a Bear, he was a turnstile. The Texans just abused him. This was 2016, and he had just signed a three-year, $18 million contract. And ever since then, he's just been steady. I remember in the middle of last year, I talked to Harry Hiestand, the offensive line coach. I said, Harry, we never ask you about Bobby Massey. And he kind of smiled. He goes, that's a good thing. That means that none of you are ever noticing him. And as you know, with an offensive lineman, the best thing to have is that no one's talking about you. And that's kind of what he's been, that you just don't see him giving up big plays at a rate that would be unacceptable. He he's not going to be a Pro Bowler. He's not going to be kind of he's not going to be any highlight reel like Quentin Nelson, going to the second level and just running guys over. He's just going to do his job. He's got great size over there. He knows the game well. And this is a group now. The entire starting five is back. Four of those five players, this is going to be their fourth year playing together, which is really hard to do in the NFL. And bringing Massey back is part of making that work.
Yeah, I think that's a great point about the continuity of the offensive line. The only question mark, though, not because of his skill set, but just because of his durability, Kevin, is Kyle Long, who plays right next to Bobby Massey at the right guard spot. He struggled to even play 10 games over the last few seasons. What's his outlook? What's his health concerns at this point?
Yeah, Kyle Long said to us right before the winter break, he said, I'm injury-free, surgery-free this offseason. Last year, he had four surgeries from the end of 2016 17, leading into 2018. He would practice, two practices in a row, then take a day off. Another practice, take a day off. And then he had kind of the freak, foot injury late in the Jets game that kind of kept him out all the way until the season finale. And then he was able to play in the playoff game, and he admitted he didn't play well in that playoff game. So I think for him, most of his injuries have really been these freak things that have happened. You go back to the really brutal ankle injury in 2016, where he just got rolled over in the back by a fullback. Similar situation with the foot injury this past year. This is someone who is incredibly athletic. I'll give a tease. I'm working on a story right now about how great of a baseball player he was back in high school. People forget. This guy went to Florida State to play baseball. The thing with Kyle Long, when he came out of college, for him, it was just, you were so much bigger, stronger, faster than everybody else, you're going to be fine. Now that he's 30, he's been in the league for a long time, now his technique is much better, and he's learned that he, ways to win without just kind of relying on his brute strength. So the best thing I can say about Kyle, no surgeries this offseason, fully healthy. He was out there every practice this spring, which is way different than last year. And you just hope that can help. And, I don't know if he's ever going to get back to when he was a Pro Bowler, but I still think he could be effective and certainly should, is set up to play a fuller season this year just because he hasn't had any issues this spring.
Lance, this may be the first time we've had a guest on the program to talk about a team and left the quarterback to last.
Yeah.
But we are going to get to Mitch Trubisky as we get down to the final minutes with you. And to be honest, as a rookie, I was not very impressed. I wasn't real high on him coming out of school, and I didn't think he did anything to get me excited as a rookie. And then last year, the productivity was there. Now, I will tell you, from not being able to watch him a whole lot, I don't know how much of that was managing a game, how much of it was smoke and mirrors. If you could give me your honest evaluation of how good Trubisky was in year two and how much upside do you think there is in year three?
Yeah, you guys didn't get to see him out there in the Meadowlands last December.
That's right, yeah, Chase Daniel.
I think by the end of the season, one of the reasons Mitch got to be numbers improved was he kind of became a little bit of a game manager. And I don't necessarily mean that negatively, because he was learning how to read defenses and take what defenses were given him. I look back to week one, Packers. They decided to play zone defense, and the Bears were not ready for it. And Mitch really had issues throughout the game. You fast forward December, same Packers defense. They ran a similar scheme, and he picked them apart. He had one of his best games of the season because he was able to learn from that. And I think there was a lot of let's kind of corral him and let's be careful. You saw the deep ball look great in late September against Tampa Bay, and they kind of reined it in a little bit. So I thought last year he was better than I expected. I think he was slightly above average, but he still, just made those throws that made you scratch your head. He made the ball would come out of his hand, and everybody would be like, "What are you doing?" Kind of said those kind of throws. He had way too many of those. I think in the 49ers game, he had back-to-back dropped interceptions in that game, and you just had you had way too many moments of that. So for him this year, he has to cut that down. I think from a physical perspective, guys, he's got everything it takes, and we saw a lot of that mobility that makes him special last year. He's got a cannon. And he throws a pretty deep ball. They just kind of didn't do it as much as in the second half of the season. We saw a little bit as they kind of rallied back against the Eagles. He had a great second half against the Eagles, but he needed to because he had a bad first half. Right. So that's the thing with him, that he has to put full games together. He has to be more consistent. I hate you. I'll do this for you guys. If I'm on Chicago radio, I never say his name. But for New York, I'll say it. There's a little Jay Cutler not in his – not from a emotional or off the field standpoint. He's everything you want off the field, and in terms of leadership. But on the field, he's got a little gunslinger. He's got all the tools, and then sometimes he just makes those throws that make you go, "Oh no, what are you doing?" Mm-hmm. So this year, the key for him, if he can get rid of those throws, and he's going to have just a natural growth from being a second year in the offense, third year in the NFL, better weapons, offensive lines back. There's going to be a natural improvement just because of all those things around him. He's going to be much more comfortable and confident, and I think that's going to help. Now he's just got to get rid of those throws. So I'm not going to sit here and say that he's going to put up outstanding, crazy numbers. I think he should be better than he was last year. And if he finds a way to become more consistent, then you can start talking about a guy who is a little bit more deserving of the Pro Bowl nod. He did get one last year, but I think he can. He has the abilities to get to that level. That's just going to come with comfort and knowledge of the game and avoiding those bad throws.
Well, and not to build in excuses, but I think personally, Kevin, you hit it right on the nose, and that's why I don't think it should be a subtle part of the commentary. But, people forget his rookie year, he's working with a different offensive coordinator, a different head coach. And then all of a sudden, Matt Nagy comes in, Helfrich comes in, and now it's a new scheme. So, you look at Mark Sanchez, you look at Alex Smith in the early stages of their careers, I point to, and I'm not selling them as unbelievable Hall of Fame quarterbacks, but they had a game of revolving doors with the offensive coordinator. So I think that's a key component about him now having year two under the same coach, the same coordinator. I mean, that could very well do wonders for still a young developing QB.
Oh, absolutely. Ryan Pace came from New Orleans, and he's always talked about the Sean Payton, Drew Brees connection. And Obviously his dream is that Matt Nagy and Mitch Trubisky can be like that and paired together. Now, it makes you wonder why he hired John Fox in the first place, if that's what he kind of wanted, but that's another story for another day. You're totally right. I almost never even look back at what Mitch did his rookie year because it was just, you get the playbook that he's never going to use again. You knew that once he got in the game, you knew this coaching staff was not going to last. He had a terrible group of wide receivers. If you looked at the three top receivers on that team last year, most of them weren't on a roster by the end of last season. So there were so many things, and just being a rookie. And remember, this is somebody that only started 11 games in college, coming into the NFL. So as I said, there's going to be just what we see around the league when a quarterback goes from year one to year two in the same playbook. There's just going to be this confidence, this comfort that he's going to be able to make throws that he wasn't maybe comfortable making. And the other thing too, guys, we talked earlier about Matt Nagy's creativity. He's going to be able to be a lot more creative, and he's going to have a bigger playbook available for Mitch Trubisky. One thing that's been a theme of this spring is last spring they would watch Alex Smith and the Chiefs offense. That was the tape that they watched. They obviously didn't watch any of the 2017 Bears, and I would hope for the sake of the sport of football, all those tapes are burned forever. But this spring, they've been able to go back and watch the 2018 Bears, and that's so helpful for everybody on offense.
Yeah, I think that's a key observation, and the reason why they would watch the Chiefs, of course, for the audience's sake, is because Nagy came from KC. He was an assistant under Andy Reid. He is Kevin Fishbane, covers the Bears for The Athletic. Kevin, great job. Really appreciate the time and the insight. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Absolutely. That is Kevin Fishbane once again weighing in on the ins and outs of the Chicago Bears. And it goes without saying the kicking competition is going to be something to watch. He doesn't seem to be too concerned with Vic Fangio to Chuck Pagano, that transition, though there is some personnel that has changed. And I agree with him. The Mitchell Trubisky year two under the offense, I mean, that's the natural progression of any young quarterback. Stability. Provide the quarterback with stability, and usually good things, or at least consistency, will follow.
Well, the one thing that he said, and he tried to say that it would not be a negative, is that Trubisky became more of a game manager. Look, we learned many years ago under Tom Coughlin, who really was insistent upon the phrase, more games are lost than they are won in this league. The truth of the matter is, he's right. That's what this has turned into. The quicksand of mediocrity basically means the team that makes more penalties, makes more mistakes, has more turnovers, goofs up, busted assignments, et cetera, that's the team that's going to lose. The margin for error in this game has changed dramatically over the years because these teams are so closely packed together. So, when you consider that philosophy, you don't want your quarterback to be more of that gunslinger kind of mentality because that's going to play against the percentages.
Well, the mistakes will pile up and you'll dig yourself in a hole and you won't be able to overcome that. And now on the flip side, by the way, Chicago was one of the most opportunistic teams, but like anything else, and we've even seen this with the Giants, just because you're a plus 12 in turnover differential, Paul, one year, you can't just sign up and say, we're going to pick up where we left off. It doesn't work like that in the NFL.
Not at all. In fact, I think of any of the, quote, key stats that people like to follow, that's the one that translates the least to next season.
Yeah, it's a fluky number. Now, I'm a believer that you could create your opportunities. I buy that, but I also don't buy that, well, you could tell me you were plus 12 one year doesn't mean now all of a sudden you're guaranteed to be in the plus 8 range at least. I've seen teams, I mean, we've seen it more often than not, Paul. You go from plus 12 to almost a minus 5.
It can happen.
In the blink of an eye.
So absolutely.
The Bears need to be careful that they're not relying on that, because that was such a key component of their team, not just their defense, special teams too, in terms of what the return game did. All right, let's open up the phone lines here in the second half of the program. Lance Metal, Paul Dottino with you here. Big Blue Kickoff Live presents presented by Coors Light. Tony is in D.C. Tony, welcome to the program. What do you got for us?
Hey, gents. Good talking to you.
Hi.
Same here. What's on your mind?
So I have some kind of old football questions that I want to get you your take on. You know, try to stretch your memories to some old football times, and they relate to the Giants. So I was talking to my pop about this whole Daniel Jones, Eli Manning thing, and he was saying that from his memory, this is one of the most unique situations a franchise has ever been in. And I was asking, well, what do you mean? And Paul, see if you can think of a time like this. My dad was saying that he cannot remember when a quarterback with the pedigree of Eli that was healthy and wanted to play was in this position. Because a lot of other quarterbacks that we compare this to, you know, Montana, you know, his brother Peyton and Favre, my dad was saying those quarterbacks were injured or they didn't know if they wanted to play anymore in Brett Favre's case. But that's not the case with Eli Manning, Tom Brady, Phillip Rivers, Ben Roethlisberger. These guys are winners, they're healthy, and they want to play. So he was saying that no team knows how to handle this. And I thought that was very interesting. You know, I just want to see if you guys kind of see it that way, or maybe you can think of an instance.
No, you know, it's funny you bring this up, because I was just thinking about this the other day, because I continue to get hammered about quarterback questions with the Giants no matter where I go. And mm-hmm. I was thinking about this, and I said, okay, well, let's see. The great quarterbacks in Giants history, Charlie Connolly was allowed to retire on his own, although, again, Tittle was there at the end of Connolly's career, and they kind of, you know, passed the baton a little bit, but he was allowed to retire. Tittle was allowed to retire because he was shot, you know, in 1964 was his final season. The team was going nowhere, and he was done. Phil Simms, you know, yes, he was cut, but he was injured, and he wound up retiring. Then you look at, you know, Jeff Hostetler. Well, now, he was traded. Hostetler, you know, Dan Reeves came in 94 after the 93 season. Phil had the rotator cuff surgery in the spring of 94. Dan Reeves wanted to keep Phil, but because of the rotator cuff surgery, George Young deemed him, with the salary cap and stuff, not a good risk. So they cut him. But it was Dan who, when he got the coaching job going into the 93 season, said, the heck with this competition between Hostetler and Simms. Simms is my guy. And they got rid of Hostetler. So you know, that was kind of, I guess, in one way, although Host didn't have the resume and he wasn't like an established starter over a long period of time, that's kind of a little bit kind of in the other vein. Kerry Collins, as you may recall, the Giants drafted Eli. Collins came in the next day and said, I want no part of this being a mentor for him. You better get rid of me. And so Ernie Accorsi acquiesced and said, okay, you're cut. I mean, it was that simple. And now we look at Eli. So, and obviously you understand the Kurt Warner situation, because when he signed here on a one-year deal, they had already drafted Eli Manning because Collins was cut. They signed Warner and told Warner, you're going to be here for a one-year placeholder because Eli's our quarterback next year. This is a chance for you to resuscitate your career and a chance for us to give Eli somebody to learn from. So they all knew what was going on with that deal. So you are right in some degree here, where it is a rather unique situation where you have a quarterback, in my opinion, still playing at a high level. If he still wants to play, and this is why I tell people all the time, don't be foolish. Don't close the book on Eli Manning just yet. the possibilities are still endless here. If the Giants perform well and Eli Manning is healthy and he still wants to play and they are a playoff team this year, which don't discount that, I think Eli's getting to come back in 2020. Now, he may not be back in 21, but I see no reason why the Giants would not want to go through the natural progression of perhaps being a first-round playoff team this year if they can get in, and then say, with the core we have, why not go with Eli one more year? Because if you make it to the playoffs this year, and I know the Kansas City had the Alex Smith deal with Mahomes, and it worked out real well for them. I understand that. But more often than not, you throw a first-year starting quarterback into the mix of a team that should be making a progression to the next level of the playoffs, you're asking for trouble. It's risky, and chances are you're going to underachieve. Because that first-year starting quarterback is probably going to suffer some more lumps than what you'd like. So if you're the Giants and you can squeeze into the playoffs this year, you're going to say, you know what, the progression is that we're going to be a contender in 2020. And if Eli's still healthy and can play, why wouldn't you bring him back? It would be insanity not to bring Eli Manning back in 2020.
Well, that's why I don't think this situation is that unique, because we don't know how it's going to end with Eli. It may get to the point where Eli decides to hang it up and Jones takes over. So, I mean, I think we're getting really ahead of ourselves. And I don't think this is unique, because Alex Smith, you brought up Kansas City. I'm not comparing how it's going to work out. But the bottom line is Alex Smith had an unbelievable 2017 season. Patrick Mahomes got in the last game because they had already clinched the playoffs, and then they decided to trade him because Washington obviously gave them an offer and they were ready to hand over to Patrick Mahomes. But Alex Smith is still performing at a high level. If they would have kept Alex Smith, I could say he could go into the 2018 season as the starter and Mahomes still sits.
It certainly could have happened.
But here's the thing. And Alex Smith, I like Alex Smith. He's a great player, number one in the draft. We all know that. But when you're talking about the pedigree of the Manning brothers, Brett Favre, Joe Montana, it's not Alex Smith. Like for instance, it would be, from what my father was telling me, unusual to not allow a quarterback with that pedigree that you traded for. I know we traded for him technically, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
He said it would be unusual to not allow him to retire there. He said Marino retired where he started. Elway did. These players were a cut above. They were full-time. With Montana, he was gone for 2 years with an elbow.
Sure,
it was a very different situation.
I understand totally.
And they were also in and out of the lineup, Steve Young and Montana,
yeah,
too.
Look, here's the thing. I think what people need to understand, if the circumstances are right for Eli to come back, unless he decides he doesn't want to, okay, I do think the circumstances, if the dominoes are in the right row, you do bring Eli back for 2020, because Daniel Jones, in my opinion, has nothing but benefit to gain from sitting behind Eli for 2 years instead of one. I really believe that. I think as a two-year sponge, provided the circumstances are right, it's better for everybody that Daniel Jones takes over in 2021.
And also, by the way, Tony, Brett Favre really didn't go out on his own terms from Green Bay. If you recall, there was speculation he was going to retire and they were going to hand it over to Aaron Rodgers.
That was from him, though.
Yeah, but then he tells the team he wants back in.
He did a reverse deal, and that really caused a lot of friction.
I know it did, but Brett wasn't, he wasn't necessarily at the point where he was ready to completely call it quits. I mean, he was ready to still play, and that's why he wound up with other teams before
he gave them mixed signals over the course of time, and that's not cool.
But all I'm saying is I don't think this is as crazy unique as we're making it out to be. And that's because you're putting Eli Manning in a pedigree opposite some of these other quarterbacks simply because he won Super Bowls. I mean, Alex Smith has been in the NFL for quite some time. Alex Smith just doesn't have a ring. So, I mean, you're sort of separating the group. I'm not necessarily looking at it that way. I'd look at it as you have an established quarterback, still performing, still productive, and they go in and they draft another guy. I mean, the Chargers had Drew Brees. Phillip Rivers sat for 2 years, okay? I don't think many people remember that.
Mm-hmm.
Rivers came in 2004, and then Brees left, and then Rivers got the job.
Didn't Rodgers sit for four?
Yeah, well, Rodgers was in 05.
I mean,
and then Brett was still there for 07. He didn't come until 08. So
three years.
So for everybody to say that you draft a quarterback, he's got to come in that year or the following year. I don't think they're looking at the archives correctly, because we just gave you two where you had a quarterback sit for 2 or 3 years.
This rule about you draft a guy in the first round as a quarterback and he's got to play year one or even year two is ridiculous. It depends on the circumstances and the situation. There's nothing that says Daniel Jones has to be the starter this year or next. Nothing.
And Tony.
Yeah, I agree. And here's my second question, and I'll let you guys go.
Sure.
Now, this is a little, you know, way off the beaten path, some old Giants stuff. I am of the opinion that if Phil Simms had played in that, because you brought up Phil Simms early, and I wanted to ask you about him. If Phil Simms played in that second Super Bowl that the Giants won in 1990, he would be in the Hall of Fame. I think that because of the benchings and all of the media craziness around the Giants during that time, because when you look at other guys that I know he was playing with Warren Moon and John Elway and Joe Munt, so I understand he didn't make a whole lot of All Pros and Pro Bowls like all those other great quarterbacks.
Right,
but there are
he didn't have great receivers either, to be honest. I mean, when you know, Mark Bavaro, his tight end, was his number one passing threat. I mean, outside of his rookie season,
running around out there.
You know, no, he had Ernest Gray and Johnny Perkins early. Then he had Lionel Manuel and Bobby Johnson later. And you know, Mark Bavaro was his 1,000-yard threat. That was his guy.
Yeah.
And when you consider that the tight end is really the only big-time key threat in the passing game, and the wins of the Meadowlands, and the fact that the Giants were a run-based organization, look, I'm with you. If Phil had played and won that second Super Bowl, it'd be awfully hard for them to keep him out. I also, quite frankly, cringe every time I look at the stat sheet and I see the 199 touchdown passes, because Mark Jackson dropped what would have been career touchdown number 200 inside the Cowboys' 10-yard line, all right, in the season finale of 93. When Eddie Murray wound up coming down and kicking the overtime field goal to beat the Giants and force them into the wild card round. If Mark Jackson had just caught that ball with, like, so much real estate in front of him, he could have crawled into the end zone. Phil would have had his 200 touchdown pass. The Giants would have won the division, and they would have avoided having to go out to San Francisco in the second round after having to win a wild card game. They were beaten up. Mm-hmm. They were tired. They were hurting, and they got smoked by the Niners. I mean, I don't even want to think about what might have happened had Mark Jackson caught that touchdown pass. Given Phil number 200, the Giants would have made some waves in that postseason. I'm telling you that right now.
Yeah, and all I'm saying, look at Troy Aikman's numbers compared to Phil Jackson. Not that different.
Phil Simms, yeah.
That's all I'm saying. Thanks, guys. Love the show.
All right, Tony. Appreciate the phone call. Thanks for weighing in. It's funny because as Tony was talking, I brought up Troy Aikman's numbers because that's where I was going to go. So we were thinking on the same wavelength.
Well, he was in those Super Bowl victories, though. He engineered those.
Oh, well,
and Phil did not play in his second one. He had the broken foot.
I'm certainly not making a case that Aikman doesn't belong in the Hall of Fame. That's not where I was going to go. I was just in terms of the touchdown interception ratio that you were talking about. Aikman's got 165, whereas Simms has 199. So I guess my point is that 200 number to me is not necessarily indicative of Hall of Fame worthiness.
It's not, but it's one of those, again, standard numbers that we like to talk about in the stats world. 200 touchdown passes, especially at the time when Phil retired, was a monumental number. Nowadays, in video game football,
numbers are a joke. Yeah.
But, you know, Phil had the 4,000-yard season when it was not extremely popular.
1984.
Okay. Phil had a 500-yard passing game against the Cincinnati Bengals. Again, at a time when the passing game was not video game football like it is today. You know, he got the Super Bowl MVP with the greatest Super Bowl passing performance by a quarterback in NFL history.
Yeah.
The guy's got some pelts now on his belt and certainly deserves some consideration and never gets any, which is offensive to me. But again, I understand the true context of Phil's career. Most people around the country don't when his name comes up. But I get the point that if he plays in that second Super Bowl and wins it, it's going to be real hard for anybody to doubt
it. It changes the conversation.
It changes everything.
You got extra hardware on your resume.
And he knows that. And look, he was incredibly devastated by that broken foot that he suffered at the hands of the Bills' Bruce Smith at Giants Stadium in a horrible, sleet, rainy, cold, nasty day in a game against the Bills. Phil knew that that was like his chance to get another one. And it, you know, he got one, but he didn't get to play in the game.
Well,
and it kills him.
I think you bring up a very interesting point. You know, I think you could have this conversation in NBA basketball terms, too, about the context of the era. And when you evaluate a player, how important it is to know the style of play. Was it pass heavy, run heavy, so that you can at least compare that quarterback to others of his era, as opposed to, for example, if you compared Phil Simms to Patrick Mahomes when it's all said and done, whatever Mahomes is going to put up, we're getting ahead of ourselves, but let's project that he stays healthy. I mean, it's going to be almost like two guys in two separate leagues, essentially.
Well,
it's going to be apples and oranges.
And that's the problem, because it's very difficult to put things into context as the years move on. And it's a shame because, and to be honest with you, and it's not even fair to the guys before that, because let's face it, they didn't really start throwing the ball, you know, until the late 50s.
Of course.
Where they really started to make the passing game part of what was really going on.
Well,
in the
and then rule changes too impacted
and then
the
rule
style
changes.
Of play.
So it's almost unfair for me to say this, but at the time Phil retired, his all-time career passing rankings were a heck of a lot higher in terms of touchdown passes, yardage, stuff of that nature. He was a lot higher on the all-time lists, which you look at them and you say, hey, you know what? Maybe we should talk about this guy a little bit. But even that's not fair because, again, those all-time lists have to be taken into context in the era that you played. And, you know, is it fair to Charlie Connolly that Phil Simms' numbers blow him away when Connolly played at a time when, you know, football passing was at its infancy and Phil was playing in the 80s? That's not fair to Connolly. So it's kind of rough to be able to do that without really understanding and seeing stuff when it happened.
Well, and I think the same thing could be said for the running back comparison too. You know, if you played in an offense that emphasized the run, Paul, compared to you were the secondary option to the quarterback in the pass game, you know, that changes the conversation
well,
too.
Even the 14-game season, which then became a 16-game season.
The numbers are a little
off. O.J. Simpson ran for over 2,000 yards in a 14-game season. I lived through it. I saw it. I mean, that was unbelievable. And then since then, we've had a few guys, a handful of guys, eclipse 2,000. But they didn't do it in a 14-game season.
Well, but that goes back to context. That's why,
again,
to me, when you have those lists, see, this irritates me even when we see records in the NBA postseason. They always list numbers, but they don't give you, like, how many games played
right.
It took to reach that feat. That's kind of important, no?
Yes.
Because, like you said, the difference between doing it in 14 games versus two additional games.
And you know I'm a Yankees fan, right? But when people say to me Bernie Williams has the most career postseason home runs in Major League history, I say to myself, you know how many playoff games and World Series games Bernie Williams played in?
Yeah.
Is it any wonder? In fact, if he didn't, there'd be something wrong.
Well, I mean, that's like also saying when one player X plays 15 seasons, okay, and then player Y plays 19. Should you be surprised that 19 has better cumulative numbers than the 15?
Not at all.
Thank you.
Not at all.
I mean, but that's so hard for some people to understand in this day and age. Yeah, a player that plays an additional four seasons should put up better numbers in terms of totals. Doesn't mean they're a more efficient player or a better player. All right, let's get to Twitter because we have a few people weighing in on a few current Giants-related subjects. AJ Marshall at AJ Marshall 3. Which new Giants free agent on both sides of the ball will make an impact this season? Well, I guess it's better to word it, which do you think is going to make the biggest impact? A new free agent face on both sides of the ball. So offense and defense when you look at the Giants. Good question, and this is the time of the year where you sort of take a step back and you realize, okay, this is who the Giants brought in. These are some of the new faces. I'm bringing up the roster just because I think it's easier to talk about this when you see the names in front of you. I don't know if you have somebody in mind, Paul, that jumps out to you, whether it be on defense or offense. I'm still collecting my thoughts as I look through the roster. And he said free agent, so you really have to eliminate the rookies from this conversation too. You know what? I'll go offense first. I'll go Golden Tate. I think Golden Tate at the wide receiver spot, who does fit the bill of a new face as a free agent. I think given the fact that Odell Beckham's not here, his versatility, I mean, why would you not expect him to make a significant impact on that side of the ball?
Can I go Mike Remmers?
Mike Remmers, I think it's fair too. Absolutely. No, I think that's a good one.
You know, we're looking at that offensive line, and hopefully for his sake, he's able to stay healthy and the back doesn't flare up. And he plays a full 16 games, and the Giants have that offensive line solidified.
Defensive side of the ball, I think it's perhaps easy to go either up front because of so many new faces. I'm going to go with Antoine Bethea. I think he's going to have the biggest impact. And it may not necessarily be X's and O's. I think locker room presence, leadership, grooming Jabril Peppers, I would say he's the new face that probably will have the biggest impact on defense.
Yeah, and I think that's a good pick. But if Marcus Golden should somehow get those double-digit sacks, then he's going to have to be the guy.
Well, I noticed we picked two guys that have familiarity with James Betcher's scheme, by the way, too.
Yes.
So, you know, that's a common thread.
I think in both cases, offensively and defensively, those are the two guys. I don't think anybody else comes close to those two guys.
Yeah. Well, listen, there's a lot of new faces on both sides of the ball, whether it be new faces, veterans, and there's opportunities across the board. That, to me, is what the most exciting aspect of this year's training camp is. Not to say that in previous seasons there haven't been battles, but I think, Paul, the depth conversation is across the board. There's a lot of positions where it's wide open. You got a lot of guys that are going to be battling one another, and that's why it's interesting to talk about, you know, who is going to win these battles, who can make the biggest impact, because you've got the offensive line, you've got wide receiver, running back has depth. Defensive line has depth. We're not talking about proven. We're just talking about volume.
And names to choose from, and that's a really good thing, because when the cupboard's bare and you're just giving guys roster spots because there's nobody else, that's a bad thing. Right now, they have names to compete. That's good. That's good.
At Clayton Harden 14, bringing up, and I think we got into this also over the last few shows in terms of great assistant coaches that didn't make great head coaches. Mm-hmm. Remember you and I were talking about Wade Phillips and Norv Turner the other day? So he wants to throw out Bill Arnsparger.
Well, there's no doubt. I mean, and I know I gave Clayton a hard time the other day. I forget what it was that he had put up a couple of tweets that seemed to contradict
each other. Well, we were talking about ranking, which is the most important element that you need to see happen, the pass rush versus the offensive line. That's what we were talking about.
I know I gave him a hard time on that, but he's right on this one. Bill Arnsparger was, you know, supposed to be the genius architect of that Dolphins D for several years for Don Shula. And, you know, he comes to the Giants, and as a head coach, it just did not work at all. It was bad. So, yeah, again, another case of a great coordinator. We rattled off the other day a whole list of guys. And the list will go on because, you know what? It is a hard job. It doesn't automatically translate. This is no secret, which is why people have to be very careful when they make that jump.
Well, and that's why when you look at a lot of the new head coaches this year, I think, to me, the biggest part of a search, and I've even talked to individuals who have been previous head coaches on various shows, and the question that I always throw out, Paul, is there just seems to be a fascination in today's NFL, and we could probably expand upon this in future shows, but I just want to throw this out here at the tail end. There's a fascination in finding the X's and O's guru, much more so than, I'll use a Giants example, much more so than the Tom Coughlin-esque type of coach, meaning a guy, Paul, that could get up in front of a body of players, regardless offense, defense, special teams, motivate them, be able to divvy up his time and his effort to various portions of the team, as opposed to somebody that is just so good with scheme and dialing up these creative ways. And I'm not saying that doesn't work. I mean, Sean McVay, for example, is doing a really good job with the Rams. Matt Nagy with the Bears. So I don't want to say that there's one rule of thumb.
Right.
But we've gotten away from the leader, the figure that could command a room. We just seem to bring that down on the totem pole now.
If I may.
Sure.
We have kind of gravitated to the video game head coach who's more interested in the
pressing
plays.
The buttons and doing all that type of stuff, the gadget type of stuff.
Bells and whistles and formations and schemes, instead of a guy who can command men, who can lead a locker room. That's what you're talking about. If I were a general manager, there's no question what I would do because I'm old school. I'm going to want the leader of men as my head coach. And I will let my coordinators be the guys who are going to be the X's and O's guys and the bells and whistles guys. Let the coordinators deal with the game plans. I want my head coach to be a molder of men.
I agree with you.
And I don't think right now that's where the league is headed. It just doesn't look like it right now. And that's why for me, it's kind of sad to see how the old school guys, you know, I've said 1,000 times, the golden era of 70s and 80s in the National Football League and those head coaches. I hate to say it, but do you honestly believe that Bill Parcells, I think he has said this to people publicly. I know he has told friends of mine, who are mutual friends of mine and Parcells's, that he doesn't think he could coach in today's game right now.
Because it wouldn't surprise me.
It's not that game anymore.
Well, that's why I think it's impressive what Bill Belichick's been able to do, because
it really
he's spanned
is.
Multiple
it
generations,
really is.
Paul.
And it really is.
He's seen the evolution firsthand of players, but give him credit. He's adjusted. He still is a motivating force. But, you know, those are the types of coaches that I think are far and few in today's NFL. All right, that is going to wrap up Wednesday's edition of Big Blue Kickoff Live. Once again, thanks to Kevin Fishbane of The Athletic for joining us earlier and breaking down the Chicago Bears. Big Blue Kickoff Live will be up and running again tomorrow at noon Eastern. They will study the Jets, if I'm correct, John Schmelk and Jeff Fiegel. So they'll be breaking down the Jets on tomorrow's program, and no program on Friday for the next few weeks because our offices are closed. So we'll be back up and running on Monday.
By the way, there's no programming next week either.
That's right. I'm glad you reminded me.
July 4th week, folks.
Losing control of the
week. The office is closed, which means as much as we'd like to come in and do a show, they won't let us.
I'm glad that you
the building
brought
is
that up.
Locked. The building is locked, so no show next week.
Correct. So we're back July 8th. So we have a show once again tomorrow, noon Eastern, and then we're off till July 8th. And we'll pick up, continue to preview the 2019 opponents and break down all of the other things related to the New York Giants.
Could we get Dan maybe to come over to my house and to my own office? You can come over. We'll do a show anyway.
Well, listen, I'm all up for experimentation. I just don't know if Dan is ultra excited to
be
coming over to your house.
No, you want to spend the holiday week with your family.
I think that's the very wise choice.
You're
on the part
normal.
Of Dan.
That's your problem. You're normal.
Yes. And you, on the other hand, we're running out of vocabulary words, and we're running out of time on this program. So that's a good sign to remind us that Big Blue Kickoff Live presented by Coors Light, as always. For Paul Dottino, I'm Lance Meadow. We will speak to you tomorrow at noon Eastern. Have a good one.